Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Advocates for clean drinking water say proposed new limits by the state health department for PFOA and other chemicals in the water supply linked to cancer and other serious illnesses are too high and will lead to serious health problems. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The state health department is recommending that the drinking water supply of any New Yorker does not contain any more than 10 parts per trillion of PFOA, 10 parts per trillion of PFOS, and 1 part per billion of a related substance, 1,4-dioxane. Those sound like very small amounts, but a group of many of the state's leading environmentalists say that's still too high. Maureen Cunningham with Environmental Advocates says the chemicals can be detected and treated in humans at a level of 2 parts per trillion. So that should be the standard.
Anything else is leaving millions of New Yorkers at risk from detectable and treatable contamination.
The public comment period ended September 23rd, and the environmental group submitted testimony asking that the limits be lower. The group say the state is also behind in testing water supplies. Cunningham says 2.5 million New Yorkers in communities with 10,000 people or less have not yet had their water tested for PFOA and related chemicals. Liz Moran with the New York Public Interest Research Group says national data shows that, of the drinking water supplies that have already been tested, many contain the toxic substances.
Millions of New Yorkers already have these contaminants in their drinking water.
Moran says the testing found that 11 million New Yorkers already have 1,4-dioxane in their drinking water, and 1.5 million have PFOA and PFOS in their water supplies. Several state lawmakers also support lower threshold levels, including Assemblyman Phil Steck. The health department's proposed rules note that there are economic costs to further lowering the limits, but Steck says that's not taking into account healthcare costs when people get sick from the toxins.
The time for business as usual on these issues is over. This is not 1970, where we can have the concept that because of economic reasons, we can have acceptable levels of materials like this in our drinking water.
In Hoosick Falls, New York, Saint-Gobain for years manufactured a substance used to make nonstick Teflon. One of the byproducts is PFOA and related chemicals. Many in the town became sick with diseases linked to exposure to the chemicals, and some died of their illnesses. A few months after the regional head of the EPA warned against drinking the water, the state stepped in and provided filters for homes in the village and offered blood tests to residents. It's still seeking an alternative water source. A spokesman for the State Department of Environmental Conservation says the agency will soon be presenting options to the community about potential new drinking water sources. Other communities with PFOA water contamination problems include Petersburg and Newburgh. The environmental groups are not the only ones asking for the limits to be lowered. They also delivered postcards signed by thousands of members of the public demanding stricter standards. A spokeswoman for the state health department was noncommittal about the environmental group's request. Spokeswoman Erin Silk says the department will conduct a diligent review of all of the public comments that have been submitted, and she says it's possible that the recommendations will be revised based on those comments. Silk did not offer a timetable for when the final rules will be out, but she says once they are, systematic testing of all of the state's drinking water supplies will be completed within 90 days. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Wide-ranging conversation with the governor, of course, this week, Alan, and everything was sort of on the table. The governor has been taking a lead in many ways on issues confronting New York from the federal perspective, going after Donald Trump on everything, and including the issue of guns. He was right out in front. You were praising him at the time for his work putting together the SAFE Act. We've had even more gun control legislation in this past budget, and we have quite an anniversary this week in Las Vegas with that unbelievable mass shooting that you would have thought at that time would have brought lawmakers to the table to do something. And the governor keeps hammering on this as we watch people around the country observe this terrible tragedy.
You know, David, it's interesting because the governor has fun with me in that when we have our rather frequent conversations now, he tells me that I've never said a good thing about him and that I've always been against him. Well, in fact, that's not true. When he did his gun control thing, I wrote a column, and he actually called me, David, and he complimented me, and he said, how come you wrote something good about me? You never write anything good about me. And I said, I just wanted to make you crazy, Governor. So the fact of the matter is, I have, and when he does something good and his stance on gun control has been exemplary. He comes from Blue State, New York. We believe in gun control. Not everybody does, but we do. There are still signs all over New York, Stop the Safe Act. But he is a governor who showed some real leadership and some real guts on gun control, and he deserves a lot of credit for that, in my opinion, because this insanity keeps going on.
Yeah, the latest is these ghost guns where people can get parts of guns and then assemble them. You have some legislation moving in New York to stop that.
Well, the problem is New York is a state. Other states are, you know, crazy on this subject. You get what you want somewhere else, you bring it over into New York. It is a horrendous situation. And, you know, when little children are murdered, and I have grandchildren and I love them so much, the idea that people are going to live without these little 5-year-olds and 4-year-olds or whatever else because some nut is out there where they're doing their thing, it's just unbelievable. And, David, after I do my commentaries and I use a word like nut, I always get a call from a mental health professional who says, that's not fair because other people who have mental problems are affected by what you say. I'm sorry. You have to be crazy in order to kill a young, beautiful, basically, baby, because that's all they are. It's something that has always disturbed me.
Who will control the MTA?
Well, the governor is pretty funny on this. The governor says that basically he doesn't have the authority to control the MTA. He says there are too many people appointed by too many people. There's a subgroup that figures out the money. He says instead of having appointees to that group, what you need to do, David, is to have the principals themselves sitting there, the mayor, the governor, and let them duke it out, which is pretty funny because we know that when this governor gets in the room with any of these other people, he's as tough as they come. So he says, don't let them send their assistants there. Let them come themselves. And basically, parenthesis, I'll handle it.
Well, you pointed out to him that despite his concern about lack of control of the MTA board, when it came to the L train, he got it done.
Well, he's very proud of that. What happened is some people came to him and said, instead of shutting down the L train in Brooklyn for 2 years, you know, we can figure out how to do it as we go. He is now taking credit for having done that. I don't know. I wasn't there. But he says basically he was the guy who engineered the whole thing. Yes or no, there are a lot of people in Brooklyn who are very grateful, and I know that personally, that they don't have to find another way to get into Manhattan every morning.
Rematch, it looks like, Alan, in the 22nd District, a closely watched district, not only in New York but nationally, a sort of purple district. It's currently the seat held by Anthony Brindisi, and it looks like Claudia Tenney's going to jump back into this race. It was a real close one the last time.
Yeah, she almost won. I don't remember how many votes, maybe 500 votes, something like that, but it was very close. Now, Brindisi, who had been an assemblyman, is out there, and he is working like a demon. There is no place he doesn't go. He shows up everywhere. He has town meetings everywhere. He does have something going for him this time, and that is Donald J. Trump. The more Trump disassembles, the more New Yorkers have a feeling all is not right with this guy. It is going to be a blue election. We saw it with the congressional elections in 18. I think we're going to see much of the same thing happen in Blue State, New York this time. So that should help Brindisi, but of course, it's going to be a hard-fought race.
Saturday Night Live dipped into the political comedy even more over the weekend, of course, dealing with the impeachment hearings. But one of the things that was a sort of side skit to all this, Alan, was a feature on apple picking upstate. They had a couple of Saturday Night Live actors playing the owners of an apple picking farm, and one of the lines in the farm was, upstate, you know, where we have the southern flag.
And that's funny. There is a big difference, of course, between upstate and downstate. Look, we have a governor of New York who is very anxious to be on WAMC, and we welcome him. We think it's terrific that he does. But it's clear that he recognizes he's got an upstate problem. And there's always been that division between, blue New York City and upstate, which used to regularly elect nothing but Republicans. But that's all over now. The Assembly is blue as blue. And the Senate, the state Senate, is now blue. I think one of the things that the governor realizes is that he has to put a lot of effort into upstate New York and to make it clear that we are one state.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. The New York State budget includes a new tax incentive program for businesses that hire people in recovery from substance abuse disorders. The enabling legislation was introduced by North Country Assemblyman D. Billy Jones. He was at the business that motivated his measure this week as it submitted paperwork to qualify for the program. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there.
The Recovery Tax Credit Program will provide employers a maximum tax credit of $2,000 for each eligible person in recovery that they hire. Democrat D. Billy Jones of the 115th District says he introduced the measure after meeting with the owner of Northeast Group to discuss the idea.
This will help businesses, but also help people in recovery. Because if they take that chance on people in recovery, people will be gainfully employed. And when you have gainful employment in recovery, it provides stability to people in recovery, and it just makes for a better recovery process. And we've seen that over and over again. I expect employers to take advantage of this, and I think it'll encourage more programs to help people in recovery.
Standing in front of the Northeast Group building, Jones said that the tax credit should offset some of the costs that may be incurred when hiring people in recovery.
People in recovery, there are some things that businesses have to do. And they, while people are in recovery, they might have to go to counseling sessions or other appointments. And these businesses do invest in these people. And we wanted just a little bit of help for them to do this. And we know that in the recovery process, having a stable job, having employment is so important.
Northeast Group President and CEO Michael Carpenter says businesses often won't take chances, so they wanted to find an incentive to get people who are in recovery employed.
I'm incredibly happy that this idea was put out there because one of the biggest impediments to people finding recovery is not having a place to work. They need that purpose and that sense of I have a place that I belong. So I think it's important that this bill was passed, and I hope they continue to do it every year.
Carpenter has for years hired people in recovery. He says of the 50 full-time employees at the Northeast Group, about a third are in recovery and another third have family or friends struggling with addiction.
Everybody that we hire, whether they're in recovery or not, we talk to them about the philosophy that we have, which is we're the place that we give people second and third and fourth chances, and they really have to be able to embrace that if they want to work here. So we're committed to that, and I have people in management positions, and myself included, obviously, that are in recovery, and they've become fabulous employees.
Carpenter sat down with one of his employees to sign the documents, allowing them to participate in the Recovery Tax Credit Program.
You are signing right there, young Brandon.
Actually, Brandon is the first one to sign up for this, first one to sign here, and, it's great to have him, and we want to have people take a chance on these individuals that are struggling a bit in their lives, and it's an important program, and I hope people take advantage of it.
SPARC, Substance Abuse Prevention and Recovery of Clinton County member and United Way CEO John Bernardi, hopes the program also helps destigmatize addiction and recovery.
We want people who need help to come forward and ask for help and do so in a way that they can be proud of. And we want our wonderful community to embrace that opportunity and never to stigmatize people for needing help or asking for help. And this is an example of our anti-stigma efforts across the region, so a sort of a hidden benefit.
The Recovery Tax Credit Program is administered through the Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Services. The 2020 funding totals $2 million statewide.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Well, they're both former members of the New York State Assembly, and they both represented the state's 22nd district in the House of Representatives. And now Claudia Tenney and Anthony Brindisi are heading for a possible rematch of their 28 race in a very closely watched district in the country. As the Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickus reports, President Trump carried the district in 2016.
New York's 22nd House District stretches from the Pennsylvania border to Binghamton, northeast to Utica, and northwest to the shores of Lake Ontario. And it's had three different representatives over the past three terms. Republican Richard Hanna retired in 2016, Republican Claudia Tenney replaced him, and then Democrat Anthony Brindisi unseated her in a squeaker as the Democrats took control of the House in 2018. But Tenney remained in public view, even attending this year's State of the Union address. On Tuesday, Tenney confirmed the long-expected news in a campaign video. She's running again.
This is home. It always has been.
Online experts who rate House races list New York 22 as a Democratic toss-up. Brindisi spoke on WAMC's Congressional Corner just after Tenney's video was posted.
Well, look, whoever the nominee is on the Republican side, we're going to take very seriously, and I believe that I have an obligation in the meantime, up until the election, to really work on the issues that people care most about in this district, and that's what I'm focused on doing, and there's going to be lots of time for politics.
Tenney lost the seat with 49% of the vote in 2018, as Brindisi garnered 51% after a bitter race. From the start, Brindisi has sold himself as a moderate. He voted against Nancy Pelosi in her ultimately successful bid to return as Speaker and has urged restraint during the run-up to impeachment proceedings against President Trump. Brindisi also addressed that issue Tuesday.
These are very serious allegations that impact our national security, and I have a responsibility under my oath that I took to the Constitution to be very thoughtful, to be intentional, and to work to find the facts.
Notably, Tenney did not mention the name Trump in her video, even though the president and his family were prominent backers in 2018. WAMC has requested an interview with Tenney, who in the past has embraced unfounded conspiracy theories relating to the deep state and claimed many mass shooters are Democrats.
Republicans and Democrats from the Southern Tier to the Mohawk Valley, all across central New York, people get up every day and fight.
For his part, Brindisi suggested he wants his record to speak for itself.
I'm not worried. I think we have a long time to go before the election happens. We have a year out before the congressional race happens, and there's going to be a lot of time for politics during that time period. But the one thing that I would always hear during the campaign last time around that would frustrate people more than anything is we have these endless elections, and they just want people who, after the elections are done, sit down and actually work on governing.
There's more on the race at WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Ian Pickus.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A new report by New York State's comptroller finds 25 local governments are in some form of fiscal stress. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Democratic comptroller Thomas DiNapoli says nearly 6 million New Yorkers live in a community struggling with fiscal stress. Assistant Comptroller Tracy Hitchin Boyd, with the Division of Local Government and School Accountability, says DiNapoli's fiscal stress monitoring system, rolled out in 2013, acts as a red flag for communities drifting toward red ink.
On the heels of the Great Recession, when we were seeing local governments and even some states falter fiscally, people within New York State were asking, could that happen here, and what are we doing to avoid those issues? And the controller asked our division to analyze local government fiscal stability and come up with an early warning system that would identify local governments before they got to the point of serious financial troubles.
Hitchin Boyd says headlines seem to indicate that the numbers of local governments appear to be stabilizing.
But when you scratch the surface, you'll see there's news there, in that the specific local governments that are experiencing stress change from year to year, and also the level of stress that they're in changes from year to year. I would mention that our report recently speaks to how in a number of the regions in the area that stress appears to have been reduced, but for the Mohawk Valley, where we saw a significant increase this year in local governments and stress.
DiNapoli's list is based on analysis of data compiled from annual financial reports local governments submit. The system evaluates those governments on financial indicators, including fixed costs, short-term borrowing, and cash on hand, which help determine local stress scores. Hitchin Boyd notes a Montgomery County municipality tops the report's significant fiscal stress list with a score of 85.
The city of Amsterdam reported their financials to our office for the first time in a few years within the necessary time frame to be scored under the fiscal stress monitoring system. That in itself is a bit of a red flag, and we've been working with the city to comply with their reporting requirements. But the fact that they scored where they did would indicate that they are among the entities in New York State, among the cities, towns, and villages and counties that are among the most stressed. And essentially, the components of their score would indicate that they have low fund balance, for example. That means that they have relatively little financial flexibility to address any future uncertainties and on their fiscal horizon.
Amsterdam City Controller Matthew Agresta.
We've taken all the, I think, necessary steps to ensure that if some emergency did arise, that we would be able to account for and handle whatever that may be. The long-term goal would be to ensure that going forward, the City of Amsterdam has a healthy fund balance in all of its operating funds, which at this point we do not, but have taken steps to start moving in that direction.
Another Mohawk Valley community, the town of German Flats, is second on the stress list with a score of 81.7. In the Hudson Valley, the city of Poughkeepsie and Westchester County appear on the significant stress list, scoring 71.7 and 69.6, respectively. There's more at WAMC.org. Dave Lucas, WAMC News.
The city of Troy, New York, is perhaps best known as the home of Uncle Sam, but its history goes well beyond that. To that end, a new 80-foot downtown mural recently unveiled is celebrating Troy's long history. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there and filed this report.
This is for the people of Troy. Troy has a rich history of architectural and character people, and it's just a pleasure to incorporate that in the wall. And I hope everyone likes it and enjoys it for many years.
Artist Kevin Clark painted the finishing touches on River Street's Headley building on Friday. Once home to Kluett, Peabody & Co.'s Collar Manufacturing Company, the 1917 building once again sports a facade of red bricks and large windows. A faded sign for the factory's later incarnation, Arrow, splits the mural down the middle. When planning the painting, Clark says he wanted to recreate as much of the building's original character as possible, but otherwise the objective was simple.
Don't suck, because usually when you do something like this, it lasts for decades. So if it is something I'm not proud of, I have to figure out a way to avoid looking at it for quite a while.
At one point, Kathy Sheehan of the Rensselaer County Historical Society says as many as 7,500 workers, mostly women, fueled the Arrow factory, making detachable men's shirt collars, pajamas, underwear, and more, hence the Collar City. Once the factory closed down and Troy fell on hard times, auto dealer John Headley helped modernize and redevelop the space for local businesses, like today's River Street Market. Sheehan points to a figure of Headley painted into the mural's bottom right corner.
Of course, he's the one on the end near the Cadillac, because he took over his father's Cadillac business and had that right just to the north of this building. But John is the one who had that vision. He really had the vision of Troy when Troy was a little shaky at those years, and he said, no, we're going to do this.
Headley isn't the only notable figure from Troy to make the cut. To his left stands women's rights activist Emma Willard, now remembered at the eponymous girls' school. Author Herman Melville, who called the city home while writing his first two novels, clutches a copy of Moby Dick while leaning on a produce stand. And decked out in stars and stripes, Uncle Sam balances a bushel of apples in the middle of the crowd.
Samuel Wilson, the progenitor of our nation's symbol, his businesses started right in Troy. He supplied the beef to the troops during the War of 1812, and John Fitzgerald Kennedy signed it into law that Samuel Wilson is the person who we have based Uncle Sam on, and Troy is the official home.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1940. Or just listen to our podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.